This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite is sponsored by Mellanox Technologies, the leading supplier of end-to-end FDR 56 gigabits per second InfiniBand and 10 and 40 gigabit Ethernet interconnect solutions for HPC and cloud server and storage clustering. www.mellanox.com.
This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry, with Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Hello, I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm in Hamburg, Germany at the International Supercomputing Conference. This is a special ISC edition of Soundbite, one of three we're doing here at the conference. So right now it's June 17th, the day before the new Top 500 list gets published, and I'm joined today by the creators and maintainers of that list, Hans Moyer, Eric Strohmeyer, Jack Dungar, and Horst Simon. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Welcome. Good evening.
Welcome.
So we're not going to talk about a particular list today. We're certainly not going to talk about tomorrow's list because that's top secret. So this is the 20th anniversary of the Top 500, and what I'd like to do here is sort of discuss that list in a somewhat broader context, sort of a historical context. And we know the Top 500 is all about Linpack, but outside of just that horse race that the press is interested in, the press outside of HPC especially, of tracking the fastest computers, you guys gather a lot of other information about these systems, the underlying technology components, their energy use, the country's origin, vendors, so on. And you track these things over time, so you've got a nice 20-year track record of all these things. So today, outside of the Linpack rankings, what do you guys think are sort of the most important aspects to this list? Jack, what do you think?
Well, there's a number of things besides the performance of the computers and the ranking, as you point out. We track things that relate to technology. For instance, the number of cores that are present on these systems. We track interconnects, and we see how the interconnects change over time. So there's a number of facets to these machines which are varying over time. And looking at them presents an interesting perspective on where high-performance computing has been and where things are going in the future.
So I was thinking that the other big piece of information that gets a lot of attention outside is actually the country and continent statistic. And just in recent years, we've seen, and the top 500 list has documented this, the rise of supercomputing in China. And the important thing is it's not just one or two big machines, but we see that China has a very substantial investment and has now the second most machines in any country. And so this is a trend that would be very difficult to spot with anything else but the top 500.
Yeah. What do you think, Eric?
So what I noticed over the years that the interest actually changes. I think in the early days it was things like the main memory of the machines and the disk attached and things like these. That switched to people being very interested whether it was a tightly integrated MPP machine or a cluster of PCs. I would say right now it is the power consumption of machines and how that develops and power efficiency. And going forward, I would actually expect that it becomes more about applications and how we program machines. So the information we record about which applications are running and how people program these machines is going to become very important in the future.
How do you think?
I believe that the main advantage of our approach with Linpack is that we come up with one number. Also, we know that one number cannot describe a complex thing like a supercomputer, but this number gives us a chance to have a competition in the field, a competition between countries mentioned by us, a competition between manufacturers, and even a competition between sites.
Yeah, I love that you guys collect all that information, because as a journalist, I tell you, I use those statistics all the time when I go through it. If it was just a static list, I would have a hard time writing about it, but that makes it a lot more interesting to know all those different pieces of the technology and the vendors and all those, that information. So that's much appreciated. And in fact, my next question sort of being along those lines, if you guys think about adding more more information to that list, if you could make the owners of these systems give you one more piece of information about these supercomputers, what would it be, Jack?
Well, let's see, one more piece of information. So perhaps the cost. So a question that comes up frequently is, what is the cost of a system, and what's the, then translate that into what's the efficiency based on the cost, so what's the price performance? And we don't collect that for a number of reasons, some of which are good and some of which are perhaps not so good, but that would be one additional thing, I think, that would help.
Well, I would like to suggest that we should look at data as a constant debate now, and saying big data is the next big thing, and that comes from high-performance computing. And I think this requires a little bit thought, because just like LINPACK happens to be, as Hans pointed out, one number that makes it very helpful to rank the systems for performance, we would have to think about some clever way of coming up with one number which very well characterizes the whole memory hierarchy, that is, understands how we move data through the system. And I don't have any particular idea, but if somebody could come up with one of those numbers to characterize the system in terms of how it can perform data analysis.
Well, what do you think the Graph 500 benchmarks? Are those, do you think those are reasonable?
No, I don't think Graph 500 will address that question. Graph 500 is basically, again, a benchmark that looks at performance of floating point units and moving a small amount of data in the system. What I'm talking about it is how you do large-scale data analysis where you have really move, let's say in the future, gigabytes to terabytes through a memory hierarchy and characterize that. So it's sort of, it's not the sparsity, it's the bulk movement and the fact that we have more complex memory hierarchies that we don't really characterize well.
What do you think?
Well, if I pick something different from the two already mentioned, I would go back to how systems are actually used in terms of applications, how large the jobs are, and what their actual sustained performance is. Sustained performance, of course, is a very raw subject, has been from the very beginning,
yeah.
And it will remain one. What is the real performance under real applications?
Yeah, I agree, and I see it similar as Horst, that big data is the next step. And since we, with our LINPACK approach, are measuring floating point crunching, but not data crunching, it is not enough to do just this LINPACK approach in the future. I'm completely convinced about that. So, as we said at the very beginning of this, if there will come up another better measure than LINPACK, we will switch to that. But since 20 years, we haven't done that.
Right. You know? Well, have you guys talked about doing a big data benchmark, a set of benchmarks?
Not yet. Not yet.
But you're obviously, you guys are thinking about it.
Well, it's an important topic, clearly, so it should be addressed at some point.
But it is the next step and very important. Not number crunching, but data crunching.
But it is also a subject which has been on the table for decades, and it is actually much more difficult to come up with a good characterization of data usage than with a good characterization of floating point usage.
Mellanox's end-to-end FDR 56 gigabits per second InfiniBand and 10 and 40 gigabit Ethernet interconnect products, consisting of ConnectX-3 adapter products, the comprehensive SwitchX family of fixed and modular switches, software, and cables, deliver industry-leading performance, scalability, efficiency, and economics for the best return on investment for performance interconnects. Mellanox provides its worldwide customers with the broadest, most advanced, and highest performing end-to-end interconnect solutions for the world's most compute-demanding applications. For more information on Mellanox's end-to-end connectivity solutions for HPC and cloud server and storage clustering, visit www.mellanox.com.
So, getting back to that floating point, I mean, you guys have tracked performance over the last 20 years, and one thing I think everybody notices that, Eric, when you give these presentations, you bring up the fact that, you know, you've got this, you know, constant sort of slope of performance aggregation for the list, and even for the bottom of the list, and even the top is a little more jagged, but it's going on the same line. Basically, we see a 1,000-fold increased performance over 10 years, and we've seen that really over the last 20 years. Now, that's not related to the Moore's Law or any other underlying technology that are in these systems. They're not increasing necessarily at that rate. So what's driving the 10x or the 1,000x increase over 10 years? Eric, why don't you talk about that? I think you've talked about it most in the past.
I think it's the combination confluence of two things. Of course, it's a specific industry which is driven by Moore's Law. And without Moore's Law, it would be very difficult to sustain any growth at that rate. There's no doubt about that. But Moore's Law by itself is probably not sufficient to really, at the high end, have this factor of 1,000 in 11 years, 10 years, 11 years. I think what's really needed there and often overlooked is our ability of the scientific community, of the user community, to change their behavior in their programming, their style of programming, and change our technologies and how we use these machines and come up with new ways to go around all the obstacles we encounter while we increase the size of the machines and increase the size of the components. So far, whenever we had a shortcoming, we couldn't build the traditional vector computers anymore. We went to parallel computers. We couldn't afford those anymore. We went to clusters. Now we are facing an energy crisis, and we are dealing with that. We're changing our architectures, and we are changing our programs. And without changing the programs constantly, rewriting our software constantly, we would not see that factor of 1,000 in 10 years.
Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I would echo that. That is to say, there's been improvements in various aspects. Hardware clearly is one, and let's say that's driven by Moore's Law. But there have been improvements in algorithms that that have been used to solve problems, and those improvements give us additional boost. They sort of compound the improvements that come about from Moore's Law to really enhance the performance beyond that level.
I wanted to add another observation, which would be great if we could actually quantify it. And I think that in particular, the top 20 or top 30 machines on the top 500 list actually have grown in size over the last decade or so. We all remember probably the saying that a supercomputer is a computer that costs more than $25 million. And I think by now we've reached the $25 million does not get you a supercomputer that would be on the top 25 of the list. So the budgets have gone up. And so there's a question, why is it that suddenly we're talking about $50 million supercomputer acquisitions? And here's a theory, we can debate this, is it really has become much more complex and much more costly to run a center and to have a supercomputer in a center. And so if we look at, around, there are less and less sites that can actually provide the infrastructure, both the power, the buildings, but also the intellectual infrastructure, the number of people that can actually run. So there has been, I think, a concentration to smaller number, to bigger systems that require, let me say it this way, bigger systems that get sort of amortized over the existing infrastructure better. But that's just a theory that I'm throwing out here, and I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like, obviously, to get beyond Moore's Law, you do need more components.
Yeah, you need more.
You need to multiply the processors, because Moore's Law is giving you know, the 2x over 18 months or whatever. Yeah, I think that's a good observation for sure.
Well, Eric did the analysis, and he said that if you look at Moore's Law versus top 500 growth, the two multiplicative factors are Moore's Law times parallelism. So parallelism has been increasing the same way that Moore's Law has been increasing, but that means we buy bigger and bigger systems, bigger and bigger, more parallel systems.
There is an additional 20 or 30% a year growth in terms of how many components we actually cram in those machines. Yeah. And part of that is actually that they physically get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, we have figured out that, you know, that Moore's Law states that There is a doubling in performance if you look at chips in 18 months.
Right.
But we see that our performance growth is much faster. We see doubling in 12 months for the number one system. That is the difference, of course.
Right.
So that's something more than Moore's law, which is influencing this.
So, I mean, looking at that constant growth that you guys have seen, I mean, do you see anything technology-wise or otherwise that's going to change that trajectory over the next, let's say, 5 or 10 years? Are there things happening now, like with power consumption or anything else, that's going to change that slope, do you think?
So let me start and point out that I'm in some sense a pessimist, because I have a 2,000 euro bet that we won't have an exaflop system on the top 500 list before 2020. My opponent here in the bet is Thomas Lippert, who is an optimist and believes that there will be a exaflop Linpack system installed somewhere in the world before 2020. So why did I bet this bet? Because I think we still have not yet addressed the power problem on supercomputers. So the interesting thing is the exaflop discussion is now going on for about 5 years. We had in 2007 the very first set of exaflop town hall meetings. In those meetings, and I remember actually, and Jack was probably also in the room, the discussion we had at the Oak Ridge town hall meeting, that a exaflop computer would require probably 200 megawatt, 300 megawatt of power. We are today not any closer to building this. So we have to basically make the technology 100 times more energy efficient, and then be willing to build for a computer center that can house a 20 to 30 megawatt system. So I think that we can push building the outside environment, the infrastructure, for maybe a 20 to 30 megawatt computer center, but I haven't seen the factor of 100 improvement. I haven't even seen anything on the trajectory to see a factor of 100 efficiency and energy efficiency improvements.
Right.
Again, Eric is tracking this, and we've seen improvements, but they're not on that level.
Yes. Yeah, I know, I've written about this, that the improvements we've seen, you know, most recently are not tracking to that level.
Yes.
So there's a missing piece of technology or technologies, yes, that need to be here. So
right.
That's a good observation. What do you think, Jack?
Well, you know, there's many obstacles to getting there. Horst has pointed out a few: cost, power, programmability of such systems. The willingness of the government to make such an investment, so making this a priority. Is there a need for this kind of a device? All enter into the picture, I think.
Well, were these questions being asked from teraflop to petaflop, or are these new questions that really, I mean, because that happened, obviously. So
I would say that those were questions that were asked at those periods, and they were answered in a positive way. I would say that the questions are being asked again, and we're not sure if they're going to be answered in a positive way. Right. So is there a willingness by the governments to do the investment that's necessary to get to that point is one of the issues.
So the way I would say it, if you look back and look at the petaflops report that was produced in the mid-1990s, it has three technology paths to the petaflop, and we went one of those three paths. And it was, but if you ask today somebody what is actually the technology path that will lead us to an exaflop computer that might hopefully have 200 petabytes of memory and can run in only 20 to 30 megawatts, there isn't anybody out there who can tell you what that path might be, not even an engineering path. And I think that's scary that it's only 8 years away.
Although, you know, you talk to the vendors, Cray and NVIDIA, they're very bullish on this. They think they could do it in 2018, and they think they can meet the power.
But here's the point. You ask everybody, and they say flops are free. So an exaflop computer doesn't cost anything. It's the memory.
That's right.
This morning, I attended a workshop here at our conference, HPC in Asia. And there was a talk by a guy from Riken, and he said, of course, you know that due to their 5 years planning, they expect 100 petaflops computer in 2015. They will come up with an 100 petaflops computer at 2015. And if we make our projections, the first petaflops computer came up with Roadrun in 2008. 8 years later, in 2016, we only have petaflops supercomputers in the top 500 list. That is also more or less true. We have had in the last two lists, in November and last June, 10 petaflop systems, the same, by the way, and now we have 20 already. So this is getting momentum, and I am still in favor of having an exaflops computer at 2019, that is our projection. But I agree that for me the most important problem is the power consumption, the energy consumption. And I don't see, I know that you guys from the US are claiming, or one idea is not more than 20 megawatt. I don't see how to do that. You know, K computer has 12.5 megawatt. Now it is going down a bit in the new list, but not so much that we can.
Well, we've got to remember the 20 megawatts is an arbitrary number that somebody puts on the table. Yeah, that's a challenge, basically.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That is, they can pay for that, say.
Yeah, and it may be more than that.
Yeah,
it may not be a lot more than that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the first systems could blow the budget, yeah. And then there'll be one of those, and then.
But
it's a question of throwing money at the problem in some sense. So yeah. If you were to invest in it in a serious way, you can build it. I mean, if we take a look at the 10 petaflop system that we have today, put together 100 of those systems, and we're at the point. Right. So that's one way to do it. That throws money at the problem to get to that level. Yeah. Now, it's a silly way to get to that point, but it's just a question of money at that level.
Yeah, I also think that actually the question how to build it is going to get solved one way or another. There will be an architecture. The question is, there's the compromises made in putting that together. The amount of memory we have to sacrifice, the amount of memory bandwidth we have to sacrifice, and the number of memory levels we're going to have to program, that is going to be the issue. The issue is going to be if we go down that road, are we going to arrive at a machine which we can actually program?
Yeah.
Or do we have to change totally the way we program systems? Do we have to throw MPI away and use something totally different?
Right. Well, beyond exaflops now, Tom Sterling recently wrote an article for us, and in one of the questions that I asked him, he basically said, I think we'll never get to zettaflops. He thinks 64 exaflops, he's estimating, will be the maximum number that we'll get to on a conventional supercomputer, measuring it by floating point, basically saying that, you know, we're getting down to the atoms here, there's nowhere else to go. And to do the kind of computing and supercomputing architectures we've done isn't going to work beyond the exascale era. What do you guys, let's go around the room. Jack, what do you think of that?
Well, okay, so zettaflops is 10 to the 21.
Right. 10 to the
21. Yeah. 21,
it is
20 to 21.
Not to you,
that's right.
Okay.
And I think we'll get there. Somebody once said there's plenty of room at the bottom. So, you know, maybe quantum computing can get us to that point. Arthur C. Clarke has these three laws, right? The three laws, I forgot what the three laws are of, but one of the laws says any significant advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So at some level, when we get to zettaflops, it's going to be like magic to us today in terms of that point. So I think we'll get there. I don't know what the technology will be that will drive us there. I don't know exactly what the machine architecture will look like. I don't know what the programming models will be. I don't know what algorithms will run on the machine, but I think we'll get to that point.
Yeah, so I would say the same thing. I think the one thing that you didn't ask us was when, and since the when was left open, I'd say it would be really foolish to make a statement such as flying with heavier-than-air objects is impossible, or zettaflop computers are impossible. I think they're possible. The question is just when and what technology, just as Jack said. My favorite example is, so, of course, our brain does not do floating point computation, so it's not exactly.
Fortunately.
Fortunately. But our brain operates at about 30 watts.
Yeah, that and is the main advantage.
Yes, and so.
A few watts.
And there's an estimate that we have of the order of 10 petabytes in the brain. So if you think about this, there is an incredible efficiency in biological systems that we just haven't been able to engineer in our digital electronic CMOS-based computers. And I think that there might be some nature-inspired approaches to computing that we just haven't thought about.
What do you think, Eric? Xenoflops?
I'm always reminded of a study I did once where somebody asked the question, what are the longest running exponential growth rates we have seen anywhere? Because exponential growth in general is something which cannot be sustained for a long time. So other than the Big Bang and the expansion of the universe, the longest they found in human history is actually that there were studies done, bibliography studies done, how much the knowledge of humanity overall growth over time, and as a proxy they used publications, how much printed paper we have, how many publications we produce and stuff like that. And they found for at least 150 years exponential growth in how much we publish. Now, the last couple of years, I think that has changed. It's no longer paper. It's electrons and bits and bytes we produce. And in a way, that growth, exponential growth in computing is, in my opinion, just a progression of the old increasing knowledge we accumulate as humans. And just as Horst said, if we run into problems building more and more floating point operations in a system, hopefully we're going to find some other ways to increase the knowledge we have and the rate of how fast we gain knowledge through other means which are totally different, look like magic to us, and going to supersede what we have as computing today.
Maybe that has to do that supercomputing, the application, were coming from computation, fluid dynamics, and all these fields. And if we are looking at other fields we did not before, then the floating point approach may be not so important as currently. Yeah?
Well, I was going to reverse what Hans just said. The computers that we have today are still essentially the same that were invented in 1945. And the applications, that we have are still, in a sense, in 500, the same that computers, digital computers, or computers in general, were constructed in 1945. That is, solving large three-dimensional computational fluid dynamics problems. And so we have an architecture that works very well for one subset of applications. But, if you think about that, you would use a computer that was originally designed for either weather forecasting or nuclear weapon simulation and try to do computer music on it or share files. Neither one was, in a sense, an envisioned application. So we have the wrong architecture for what we're currently doing for computers.
Very good. I appreciate you guys are optimistic, and I love that you believe in magic, too. okay, well, thanks a lot. I mean, we've been talking with the Brain Trust, the top 500 here, answering some interesting questions posed to them. We've got the list coming out tomorrow morning, and Addison and I will be reporting on that in a couple days, and I know there's a lot of exciting new systems on that list, so we'll be talking about that really soon. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Appreciate the discussion.
You are welcome.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite has been sponsored by Mellanox Technologies, the leading supplier of end-to-end FDR 56 gigabits per second InfiniBand and 10 and 40 gigabit Ethernet interconnect solutions for HPC and cloud server and storage clustering. www.mellanox.com.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.